So this is our last class on The Intimate Way of Zen by James Ishmael Ford. And I am going to start off. Oh, no wonder this isn't on. I'm going to start off by reviewing the 10 Oxfording pictures and reading a really beautiful that there's verse poems for each of the pictures in this book. But I encountered a different translation along with additional commentary, I guess, by the guy who the Chinese monk who between 1100 and 1200 developed these pictures. He wrote these poems and this commentary. So I am going to share. How does that? There we go. Okay. So hopefully all can see that, and I will stop sharing once we are done with this. So reminder, these are our pictures describing our spiritual path. So I invite you to come on this little journey. And this translation is by Paul Reps and Nyogen Senzaki and can be found in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And the poem is obviously on the screen here, but the comment is not. The search for the bull or the ox. In the pasture of this world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. Following unnamed rivers lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts churring through the forest at night. Comment. The bull never has been lost. What need is there to search? Only because of separation from my true nature, I fail to find him. In the confusion of the senses, I lose even his tracks. Far from home, I see many crossroads, but which way is the right one, I know not. Greed and fear, good and bad, entangle me. Discovering the footprints. Along the riverbank under the trees, I discover the footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his prints. Deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces no more can be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward. Comment. Understanding the teaching, I see the footprints of the bull. Then I learn that just as many utensils are made of one metal, so too are myriad entities made of the fabric of self. Unless I discriminate, how will I perceive the true from the untrue? Not yet having entered the gate, nevertheless, I have discerned the path. Perceiving the bull. I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Here, no bull can hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? Comment. When one hears the voice, one can sense its source. As soon as the six senses merge, the gate is entered. Wherever one enters, one sees the head of the bull. This unity is like salt in water, like color in dye. The slightest thing is not apart from the self. Catching the bull. I seize him with a terrific struggle. His great will and power are inexhaustible. He charges to the high plateau far above the cloud mists, or in an impenetrable ravine he stands. Comment. He dwell in the forest a long time, but I caught him today. Infatuation for scenery interferes with his direction. Longing for sweeter grass, he wanders away. His mind still is stubborn and unbridled. If I wish him to submit, I must raise my whip. Taming the bull. The whip and rope are necessary, else he might stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, he becomes naturally gentle. Then, unfettered, he obeys his master. When one thought arises, another thought follows. When the first thought springs from enlightenment, all subsequent thoughts are true. Through delusion, one makes everything untrue. Delusion is not caused by objectivity. It is the result of subjectivity. Hold the nose ring tight and do not allow even a doubt. Riding the bull home. Mounting the bull slowly, I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening. Measuring with hand beats the pulsating harmony, I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me. Comment. This struggle is over. Gain and loss are assimilated. I sing the song of the village woodsman and I play the tunes of the children. Astride the bull, I observe the clouds above. Onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back. The bull transcended. Astride the bull, I reach home. I am serene. The bull too can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose, within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and rope. Comment. All is one law, not two. We only make the bull a temporary subject. It is as the relation of rabbit and trap, of fish and net. It is as gold and dross or the moon emerging from a cloud. One path of clear light travels on through endless time. Both bull and self transcended. Whip, rope, person, and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the patriarchs. Comment. Mediocrity is gone. Mind is clear of limitation. I seek no state of enlightenment. Neither do I remain where no enlightenment exists. Since I linger in neither condition, eyes cannot see me. If hundreds of birds strew my path with flowers, such praise would be meaningless. Reaching the source. Too many steps have been taken returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with that without, the river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. Comment. From the beginning, the truth is clear. Poised in silence, I observe the forms of integration and disintegration. One who is not attached to form need not be reformed. The water is emerald, the mountain is indigo, and I see that which is creating and that which is destroying. The last one. In the world, Barefoot and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now, before me, the dead trees become alive. Comment. Inside my gate, a thousand sages do not know me. The beauty of my garden is invisible. Why should one search for the footprints of the ancestors? I go to the marketplace with my wine bottle and return home with my staff. I visit the wine shop and the market, and everyone I look upon becomes enlightened. I think it'd be fun to revisit the whole path after having studied all of it. Yeah, before I go on, any just kind of responses or questions or musings inspired by that?
I was just going to mention that I've been looking through a Red Pines book lately, and in that book that you mentioned that you also have Zen Roots. Okay. Red Pine and Zen Roots, you can find this if you look in your book. The Pu Ming, I think who might have been the one that did those that you just read it from, I'm not sure. But so the way that it's worded in Red Pine's book is that the bull symbolizes desire, and that he says that in order to rein in these desires, you use the rope of meditation and the switch of the precepts. So it's a little different than how
Yeah,
I was
that's
used to it before I read Red Pine's book, which is what normally in most books the bull is supposed to, symbolize the search, I guess, for enlightenment, whereas Red Pine says that the bull symbolizes the reining in of desires, and
I had never heard that.
just thought I'd mention it
Yeah.
because I've been looking through those lately.
Leah.
I have heard the same. I always thought the ox herding pictures were about the mind and were about taming your own mind. So I concur.
Why,
And
why are you searching for your own mind?
well, it's like you're.
I mean, why? I don't understand the whole, I mean, just how would that fit with the whole, at the beginning, you're searching and then you find the footprint. And
It's like you become aware of your own thoughts, and then you tame them. I don't know. I'm just saying that before I came here, that's how I thought I knew what the ox herding pictures meant. So
I see what you're saying, though. That's a good question. I mean, I understand what you're understand exactly what you're
don't.
searching.
I've always understood them as. I mean, it's a little bit hard to put your finger on, but that.
For
But
me
maybe
too.
the
Searching
on
your mind is like the identity, like you're thinking that your mind is you. So you're trying to identify with your mind and then to control it and then to ride on your mind, right? And then you're like, this is bullshit. And you go home, set your mind free, and then you're free. No?
I don't know. That's not how,
Without
interpreted the way that I tended to, which is, searching for, I mean, enlightenment's a little trite, but I mean, I guess you're either way,
the truth is it.
you are searching for freedom, whether you think of the ox as your mind or you think of the ox as liberation or insight or something. I mean, you're searching for something, and eventually you get a hold of it. You start, figuring it out. Feel like you've gotten some kind of mastery, but then you let go of that as well. Erica.
I just wanted to add from a storytelling perspective, this story is called Voyage and Return. It's one of the story archetypes. So it's some where the hero sets off on a journey and they're convinced they have to go somewhere else to find what they're looking for. And then they figure out that they had it all along. And then they return home. So there's a lot of stories and like mythology and fiction that follow this general format as well.
Thank you. Does anybody, I mean, find this story inspiring or helpful for your practice or
Up until now, I think that in classes and stuff, you would create prompts like, has this ever happened in your practice? Or has that ever, have you experienced this? And I was often like, I don't think I have. And I was starting to get like, there were moments of anxiety, like, oh, I've been doing this for so long and I haven't had these moments, right? And going through these ox herding photos has allowed me to label moments that I've had in the past. It's like, oh, that's what that was. I am having these moments, and to kind of define them and label them a little bit better. And I've been able to look backwards and see all these moments that I've had that I couldn't really identify before as important or, something kind of cool that happened that I could reflect upon.
Yeah, and that's kind of that the beauty of breaking it down into more of this journey and process as opposed to like, are you enlightened or not? Have you experienced, you know? It's not an either or thing, right? There's moments of epiphany and change all the way along. Rachel.
I feel like the pictures kind of describe almost everyone's journey at some point or another. And it's kind of nice to see it in a picture because it makes it feel like you're not so alone, you know? Like, yes, I did see that bull. I don't know if it was a bull or not, but it was something. There was something there. You're not going crazy. And it's nice to know that it's also not linear either. It's not a straight path because sometimes you will go backwards. Sometimes you're at home and yeah, everything's great. And then it's like, but that bull's right there in the garden. Now you gotta go find it again. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with that.
Yeah, I could see. I mean, whether you interpret it as kind of searching for your heart's desire in terms of the spiritual experience, or kind of, I don't know, becoming into a relationship and taming your own mind, I definitely relate to that, you know, that sense of like, I mean, if you have been at session, at retreat, and you know, little bit of spaciousness and calmness, you know, ride the ox for a little while, and then like, you know, after a session or something, it's just like, where to go, kind of thinking maybe that, you know, the ox is a little more tame than it actually is, and then it disappears and you wonder if you're ever going to see it again. Let's see. Well, let me just read a little bit about what James says about these last two pictures. About the ninth one, the natural scene. Said in the ox herding pictures, the penultimate image is usually portrayed as a nature scene, typically without a human in sight. Here, as in the eighth stage, the shackles of our constructed reality have fully dissolved. Yet we have stepped beyond simple emptiness, the empty enso of the eighth image, and we've returned to the world. Form and emptiness are alive here. It's like a blooming branch. Rivers just are, mountains are, the oceans are. And a tenth one says, as we walk the intimate way, we pass through the many traps. We climb out of the many, many wells that we've fallen into. We touch the great mystery and find everything, absolutely everything, tumbling away. We begin to reconstruct who we are within the deep intimacies of life and death, and we fall into a couple more wells and climb out of them. After all of that, we come to the 10th of the ox herding pictures. Barefoot and shirtless, entering the market, smiling through all the dirt and grime. No immortal powers, no secret spells. Just teach the withered trees to bloom. At this point, the intimate way is not over, but it has shifted and become something new. To me, the best of images is that fat guy, that laughing, rotund Chinese Buddha. I am not it. My ideas, my desires, I own them. They play out as me, that fat guy, and my part of the great net of things. I am not it, but in truth, it is me. Here is the mysterious quality of presence. It is you and it is me, and we cannot claim to own it. As Empedocles is first thought to have said, God is a circle whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. This is the secret of the non-dual. In this place, we find that the unknown, we find the unknowing that is it. And when we find this intimate truth, we instantly return to the world. We wander freely. We bring a good word. We reach out a hand if we can. We are the infinite itself. But we are just this moment, with all the limitations being a moment brings with it. That fat guy, beauty again. So, what is the goal of our practice? It doesn't help generally to strive after goals, or at least we encourage the goal of goallessness in Soto Zen. But it is wise to ask where this path is supposed to lead. What are people like after having practiced for 5, 10, 20, 30 years? What are people supposed to be like? What are the people like who are supposedly the teachers and seniors? What ideals are presented to us in the teachings and texts? In original Buddhism, which is kind of still represented by like Theravada Buddhism, but just to go back to the oldest texts. Original Buddhism was about escape from this world of suffering. So, the Indian view of the universe was very different than what we have now, and what the Chinese, which I'll get to that. The way I understand it, I'm not a scholar, but that in ancient India, even before the Buddha's time, they had started the astronomy. They had started observing the stars and noticing, like vast, slow patterns. And they got this sense of just incredibly long periods of time. And because they were cyclic, and perhaps because life was difficult for most people, they kind of got this sense that, there's rebirth into this world of suffering, and it's just going to keep on going and going and going. And to most of us, we're kind of like, well, cool, I live again. We're like, something's not that bad, right? I don't have another life. But to them, they were like, all right, so all of the heartbreak of this life, right? Of growing old and losing your loved ones and, eventually getting sick and dying and the tough knocks of life and having to learn all this stuff. And And then, like, the slate gets wiped clean, and then you got to do it all over again, and you don't even remember what happened before. So they saw this as a negative thing. I mean, probably most people didn't. Most people were like, "Ah, that's okay. I'll just try to be reborn in a better life next time." But kind of the pinnacle of spiritual aspiration became disentangling entirely from that whole cycle. So that became the, you know, the kind of the model even of like Hinduism was to kind of rejoin the, you know, Brahma, Atman, and the Buddhists, you know, that like you achieve nirvana, and the Jains were going to escape from this world of karma. So it wasn't just Buddhism, you know, they had this overarching view of like that actually not being reborn, of escaping this world of samsara, and that there wasn't anything to be done about samsara, right? Like you could temporarily improve your conditions, or you know, there was certainly justice and generosity and those kinds of things, but you weren't going to change. Like it was always going to be a world of suffering. So that was the model. So I'm thinking that with these that oxherding pictures, right, it would just probably end with that big Enso. It would just end with like, all right. But then Buddhism goes to China. And again, I'm not a scholar. I would love to know more about this, but China meets Taoism. And Taoism has a very, very different flavor. It has a very kind of life-affirming flavor, the sense that kind of like of a way and if it all, you know, ease and not happiness per se, but ease and peace, and spiritual aspiration is about becoming one with it, right? Learning how to harmonize with the way. So that meets Buddhism, and you know, you kind of get Chan, and who knows what else happens. So we end up developing this other way of viewing the Buddhist path of seeing more that we have a true not a fixed nature, not something we can grasp, not something I can hold on to, but we have a essentially a pure nature, and what's just covered over with the clouds of, you know, thoughts and narratives and greed, hate, and delusion and stuff like that. And what we need to do is like let go of all of that. And what is revealed is actually, you know, a being who is essentially a Buddha, right? A kind and generous and open-hearted and at peace. So we're going to uncover this Buddha nature through our practice. And then we get the Bodhisattva ideal, where you know, what we're going to try to do is, again, assuming rebirth, we're, you know, that cosmology, that we're going to come back and help other beings awaken. And we're not doing that because we're like superhuman spiritual athletes. We're doing that because once we are awakened, we realize we are not separate from all beings. So how could I just go off and get enlightened and, you know, nirvana and peace and whatever, while there are other beings who are suffering? Like we're all in this together. So then we end up with these, you know, these two additional, you know, oxherding pictures. That picture of nature with no person shown, right? And this is like, I mean, this is oversimplifying, but this is like returning to the world. And this, again, this isn't just about like, you know, I've gone off to a mountaintop and gotten enlightened and now I'm re literally returning to the world. I mean, in a smaller sense, this can even be just, you know, in a moment of stillness in our zazen, and then, you know, kind of the world appears before us again. So anywhere in between all of that. So the world, it's like the world appears, but there isn't this self-consciousness about it, right? We're no longer longing for something or seeking for something. We can just appreciate it as it is, beautiful and complete. And then the 10th picture is us getting back in the business of responding to it. However we find ourselves, and the only thing that we can respond with, like James is saying, like, this big fat guy or whatever we are, right? This short lady and this, I don't know, whatever our manifestation is, that's what we have to respond in the world. So it's very significant that our model is not leaving the world. Yeah, anyone want to say anything about that? About like the kind of the goal of practice and the significance of this being our ideal, whether you can ever imagine yourself, whatever, getting enlightened and awakening to emptiness and, disappearing into an Enso and coming back or whatever, but just that this is overall, this is the model of our practice, is to come back and be fully, completely who we are.
I don't know if this is completely relevant, but it made me think of there's this book, and it's written by, it's a comedic book, but a lot of it is like the author did like a lot of research, and it's Lamb, and it's supposed to be about the story of Jesus Christ, and it's actually so like accurate that like church groups will like study it, even though it's like kind of raunchy and comedic. But one of the things he visits in the book, he's visiting the three wise men, and one of them is a Buddhist monk. And Jesus becomes, through like training with the Buddhist monks, he becomes enlightened and disappears. And he's just this like, his presence is there, and he's like talking to people, and he's completely disappeared. But what happens, and I haven't, it was a long time when I read the book, but they needed him, they needed his help. And so he let go of his enlightenment, and he returned as being like a solid person to like help his friend or something. And that is just like a perfect, like that's the,
Oh, neat.
yeah, like that's like reading that introduced that to me. And then when we start talking about it in Zen, I was like, oh, that's like the perfect example or like imagery of that. I don't know. I really recommend
I
that.
like that. I
It's
like
really
that.
cute. Yeah.
I
What
like
is
that.
that? It's called
Lamb.
Lamb. Lamb. It's really good.
It's on my shelf and I haven't read it yet.
Oh, sorry.
Oh,
Spoiler. My fault.
Andrew.
I was just gonna say too that you asked a few minutes ago what relevance the ox herding pictures had, I think, to our practice. And the first time I saw the ox herding pictures was in the book that the Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And to me personally, in my practice, the ox herding pictures aren't too terribly different from the story of the pearl that's sewn into the sleeve. To where, this person goes on this search and he's told all along that you had the pearl sewn into your sleeve the whole time. There wasn't any reason for the for all of that business. That's what it's always meant to me. And it was the first time that I kind of realized that that there's kind of nothing to attain, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, I don't know, it's not like he grabs this ox and then he brings the ox back and then he, like, I don't know, kills it and sells it or something. Like, I mean, it's not like the ox wasn't the point in a way.
Right. Well, that's what with the Enso, that's kind of what's that, the eighth picture, right? Isn't that kind of, or the merging of the self and the ox? He rides the ox home, and then the ox just kind of gradually disappears from the whole scenario.
I mean, Leah.
The Oxfording pictures 9 and 10, I'm very grateful for because that's sort of the edge of my practice. That's where I like those. I want those to be there because otherwise, if I just stop at 8, then I feel like, well, why do anything? Like, why not just go off somewhere and just meditate and do nothing? And then that makes me mad because I don't like that kind of person, you know? So I feel like, no, my whole thing is, no, I want to be useful. I want to be useful. So that 9 and 10 give me hope that that is not a, it's not a non-Zen way of thinking to actually have that engaged Buddhism mode engaged.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine there's other folks who are kind of like, geez, I wish they'd just ended at Oxfording picture 8. I just want to, like, go off into some kind of transcendent place and not have to, like, now I gotta come back to the marketplace. But depends on the person, right? What appeals to us. But the fact that we do, oh, go ahead, Eric.
I was just gonna ask, in Zen or in Buddhism, is there a way to just not come back? Like, can you just die and you're dead and just be happy, or do you always have to come back?
I don't really believe we come back.
Yeah.
I mean,
I just didn't know if, like, from a scholarly perspective, if
well, I mean, that was the whole model of Buddhism, right? Like,
yeah.
if you were really at peace and you let go as you died and you hadn't made a mess of your life, then that is what nirvana was. That is, like, then you just are not reborn. But it was understood to be really difficult. And chances are you'd come back. But you could, through that model, that it's encouraging in that sense, if you ascribe to it literally or just metaphorically, that whatever we do in this lifetime, even if we don't achieve something that we're aiming for, it's not wasted, right? Like, so then it's like, and maybe in your next lifetime you're born in, really favorable circumstances for spiritual practice or something. John.
So I got two questions. The first one, Southern school, Northern school, gradually enlightened versus completely getting enlightened. When I read the Oxfording pictures, it kind of sounds like, like the complete enlightenment. Like when you get to 8, you completely lost self, completely lost self. And I mean, besides, not just Zen, but other philosophies and religions and whatnot, you lose yourself completely, right? You get to that whole dark night of the soul, and so 9 is basically rebuilding yourself, reintegrating yourself. And some people have a hard time with it. Maybe it takes years or something like that. Versus if you just do it gradually, then you wouldn't have to do that. So can you comment on, is this gradual for small enlightenments, or is this one big, huge one, or can you comment on the two of them? And then my other question is, what's the significance of the wine bottle on your way back to the marketplace at number 10?
Yeah, he's bringing the priest in.
I mean,
Didn't see that.
I can really only speak from my experience, including, the experience of people in my sangha and teachers and all of that. That I think this the Oxfording pictures apply for. Well, I don't know if you want to call them this, smaller openings, as well as for major dramatic openings. I think, if I, my experience has been like, as much as I've tried, and, it's, that sense of non-duality of really the self falling away. I mean, it generally is just like, it's like for a moment, but it's very, very significant, right? It's very informative. That, and then there is like, okay, now how do I relate to the world after that? And then certainly for, you know, depending on the person and the situation, there can be more dramatic experiences where that whole sense of self is, it falls away so completely that the person is very, very disoriented for days or weeks or years even sometimes. And there is this integration, but I kind of see it as just, it's a matter of degree. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, I just wanted you to talk about it because I guess I kind of see the same thing, but you know, maybe Zen has a different take or an emphasis, whereas, you know, some other things say you got to completely lose yourself and reintegrate, whereas, you know, Zen, you know, the stories I get in Zen, if you like read the Denku Roku and all that kind of stuff, I mean, these people just, you know, they hit enlightenment and the next day they're cool, they're, you know, so that reintegration of self seems like it takes, you know, there's no, you know, year-long dark night of the soul in the Denku Roku. So I'm just curious if Zen and Buddhism had a different take than some of these other things that basically say you completely lose yourself. So
yeah,
and the wine bottle.
I don't really know. I mean, I get a sense that that the 10th ox herding pictures doesn't really draw the drunkenness, reckless drunkenness, but I do like, well, I mean, here's my similar story, right? Not really, kind of, I'm not saying this was post enlightenment or anything, but when I first got involved in Zen, and then I was getting really hardcore into it, and I would go to session all the time, and I would, like, I don't know, this was probably even once I got ordained, I had my head completely shaved, and, you know, I'm just like, I don't read novels, and I don't watch, you know, movies, and I'm just like, oh. And I went, my teachers still wanted me to maintain a relationship with my family, right, so that people were worried that it was in some kind of weird cult. And so I went home to visit my family. And then, like, you know, you go out to dinner and my parents get some beer. And like, and I just, at first I, you know, wouldn't do that. And then, I don't know, one time I went home and I was just like, yeah, fine. You know, yeah, give me a pint. And like, you could see they were so happy. They were just like, just look at her. You know, because in a way you realized it was like my actions were like, I mean, they could be reading that as like, I am judging them, I am holding myself apart from them, I am, you know, so there's a point at which sometimes that discipline becomes kind of selfish and unnecessary. And just kind of being with the people of the world in the way that they do and being like, sure, let's play some video games or whatever, like, you know, whatever it is you want to do is actually the way to reach them, you know, in a very sincere way. So that's what I read into it.
Cool. Skillful means. Thank you.
Yeah. Charles.
Yeah, I was just gonna comment on starting in the world and then going on this adventure and then ending in the world. And you know, it makes me think of, in one of your podcasts you were talking about like instructions for meditation and talking about like, oh, you might hear a car alarm going off in the distance or something like that. And, you know, use that as something to like practice with, as opposed to like waiting for everything to be still. And you know, and I've always tried to like embrace that with my meditation, like, and maybe even to a detriment at some point where I'm like, maybe I don't need to be meditating with all this chaos going around. But yeah, I do think like if the story was you're starting off in nirvana or like at full like Zen, full peace, then like how would you even get there? Or like what does that mean to the rest of us that aren't like, you know? So I think, yeah, start like that's how it's gonna happen, is you're gonna eventually come back down to earth and be back in the world, and you have to figure out how to cope with that, what you just went through. But then you also have to like, you can't just magically appear in like the present moment whenever you want to, and you can't like wait around to be in the present moment, then I'll be Zen when everything is still and I'm fully silent. And like has to start in the world. And I think that's part of what I love a lot about Zen and Buddhism, is its relationship to the world.
Dave?
I was also obsessing about the wine a little bit, but I don't think that the wine has anything to do with the monk at all. I think I think it's kind of his understanding, his own awakening, because he has it when he goes to the market, he has it at the market, and he has it when he's going back. I think it has more to do with the people who are observing him, because there comes somebody down the road for no obvious reason, just joyful and light, who probably appears to be drunk to them, you know, because he's looking at this dead tree and sees life in it. He could probably look at a dog turd and see a sunrise. He's just like completely enamored with the world. So I can just imagine the villagers saying, well, I want to get some of what that guy's got. Like, look at him go. And next thing you know, they're out looking for oxes of their own, right?
Yeah, is he just carrying around the wine jug? Because
it's just, it's an illusion thing.
It's a little like,
he looks like he has wine, but he's just buying his own supply.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty cute cat, John.
Yeah, very. Like a lot of attention.
I met my daughters and she has four cats, so we're sort of inundated by them.
So, you know, we return to the marketplace, and in a sense we could say there was never anything to search for and all that, but that doesn't mean there is no path. And that doesn't mean that we should just go about our lives as usual, because this is it. Like what we see and perceive now. There's nothing more than that. There is a famous verse, which I thought Dogen said it, and he might refer to it somewhere, but I tracked it down today. Let me tell you, I'm so irritated when I discover stuff online and they quote it and they do not say where it's from. And they just quote it and they say, this is a cool quote. And then they say like Dogen. It's like, anyway, I tracked down, and this is from a Chan master, Master Yun Men, and he was, I don't know, yeah, hundreds and hundreds of years ago anyway, in China. 30 years ago, before I practiced Chan, I saw that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. However, after having achieved intimate knowledge and having gotten away in, I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. But now that I have found rest, as before, I see mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers.
Again?
At first we see, you know, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Are. So yeah. We go, I know what that is. There's a mountain. Related. Then, you know, we challenge our minds. We challenge them with Dharma teachings and with Zazen and with retreat. And we kind of like, and then, you know, like I say, we kind of see, we recognize that we've been navigating by a mental map of reality, and that map is not reality itself. So it's not that the map is useless or that it goes away or something. We just recognize, oh, like that doesn't necessarily, and sometimes that map can fall away for a little bit, and we just see reality with a capital R, and we recognize that the, you know, we overlay the concept of mountain or river. I mean, and they're useful concepts, right? But they're like, where does a mountain begin and end? How far below the ground does it go? A river, we say, oh, there's a river, but like, is the river the water flowing in it? Because the water flows by and then it's different water. Is that the same river? Well, it's the river bed. Like where is the river? And it's same with us, same with everything that we conceive of. And that isn't all there is to it. I mean, essentially we go, dang, I've been navigating by this mental map and it's a lot about reality I don't know. Like, who am I and how do I operate in this world? And how big is this universe? And what is the nature of time? And like all of this we can investigate. But then, so that at the end, then when we see mountains and mountains and rivers as rivers, it's not just that our mental map I mean the mental map comes back because we have to operate. But maybe I would say it's like, yeah, it's like we readily pick up that mental map, right? We just be like, oh, retreat's over. Time to pick up my mental map. But at the same time, we maintain that full awareness that this is just my mental map. This is not reality. And also having that sense of connection to what is deeper and real at the same time. So that's my very inelegant explanation of that development. Wow, there's 9 o'clock. Perfect. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna.
Have a good night, guys, and thank you.